This session is on pitfalls. It's negative in nature. I don't think anybody woke up this morning thinking, where is that pit to fall into? No, it's not something we aspire to. But the fact of the matter is, we are probably going to strike out. It might be our fault. It might not be our fault. A number of years ago, a story was shared here that just sort of stuck with me. There's a lot of stories that are shared here. This one's stuck. Zuve Steinman was telling how he and his wife decided they're going to have tomatoes in their garden. So they went out and bought a little pony pack of 6 tomato plants, and then they planted them in a row and smiled the smiles that gardeners have when they're aspiring to raise tomatoes and have just planted. A little later that afternoon, his wife came to him and said, "How many plants did we plant? How many did we buy?" And he said, 6. And she said, "You're not going to believe this, but there's only 5 out there now." And he went and looked. And she was right. Neat row. Had been 6. He knew there were 6. They bought 6. There were 6 in the pack. There were 6 that they smiled upon. Now there were 5. But, well, that's really strange. How did we get from 6 to 5? It's one of those things, life's mysteries, I guess. That evening he was sitting outside on his lawn chair, and he noticed one of those plants just start shaking, and it started shaking, the whole thing disappeared into the ground. It was a gopher. It pulled that plant right out. Gophers were taking them. There's going to be some days that the gophers get in your teaching. It's not the way you intended. It's not what you wanted. It's not why you became a gardener or a teacher. There will be some lessons that the gophers got. However, responsible gardeners are concerned about gophers. Yes, of course they are. And responsible gardeners can insult the gophers, right? We're kind of back to the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. An altered serenity prayer reads this way: God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that that's me. Many pitfalls are indeed something within our own control. It's hard work to change yourself. It's hard work to change this old man. I think you probably found it the same way with yourself. It's hard to change habits. We can aspire to greatness. We can be encouraged when we listen to a sermon or when we read our Bible or whatever it is. We want change, but you know, change is tough in ourselves. But you know what's harder than changing yourself? Changing the other guy. That's harder still. It's easy to blame other people. It's easy to blame the gophers. But harder than changing yourself is changing others. You're kind of on a long preamble. You didn't get to your handout yet. I want to share this yet. In the early days of the American automobile, a lot of people had Model Ts. And to start a Model T, you had to stick a crank in the front and you had to crank it. If you didn't quite know what you were doing, and many people didn't, the crank would stay engaged after the engine fired and would come and give you a real nasty slap on the wrist. And in fact, it would break people's wrists. And this became so prevalent that in the medical world, they began to call it the Ford fracture. Everybody was getting their wrists broken at the same spot. Well, teaching is a little bit like that, in that you'll notice on the sheet there are 4 main points. There are 4 different Ford fractures identified here. You see, teaching, it's a little like the Model T, and it tends to buck in the same way. And it tends to catch us a little bit the same way because we're all built across the same framework. So there is at least some predictability to the pothole. It's not like Peter when he was walking along in the water and all of a sudden things were going pretty good and all of a sudden down he went. Just when all the disciples back in the boat were saying, "See Peter go." All right, it doesn't come on you quite that unexpectedly. And this is about prior preparation. This is about studying how we actually, make mistakes and how we fall. And so, in that, like I said, it's kind of negative in nature. But the real sobering truth is, and you probably know some situations like this, that some teachers don't finish the year. I know of some that were out of whatever, out of steam, out of trust by Thanksgiving. It happens, right? Some teachers aren't asked back. And that doesn't necessarily mean it was all personal failure. Some people just weren't meant for the job. I believe that teaching is a gift. It is a gift that is developed, like any other gift is developed. But there's some gifts that I don't have. And so I can't do. There's certain things in this world that I can't do. I've tried to do them, wanted to do them very badly, but in fact I couldn't do them. But at this point, let's just be sobered by the fact that depending on how we relate to these pitfalls, how many we fall in, how many we climb out of, it's going to determine our ultimate success or failure. Oftentimes, maybe being let go is our own problem. We'll talk more about some of this along the way. Let's get into our four general pits that we can fall into. Four different items here on our handouts. First is faulty self-concept. We're thinking now about how we think about ourselves. This comes out in many different ways, and here are some ways that it comes out in the classroom. Here are some ways that a faulty self-concept shows up in a teacher's life. The first is apologizing too much. Right? And this is not in order of importance. These are just as they came to me. And also, I should say right now, this book has been a tremendous resource. There's actually a chapter in this book on pitfalls. You might want to read it. Okay. I had a teacher who apologized too much. She dropped something, she'd apologize. She'd hand something to you and if the paper was upside down, she'd apologize. If she had to start a sentence the second time, she'd apologize for that too. And it was annoying. And we boys sort of mocked her at recess time. You know, if something didn't go quite right, we'd say in the same way that she would say, "Oh, I'm so sorry." It didn't make for effective teaching. It didn't. There's no need to announce your mistakes, your faults, your phobias, your weaknesses. Announcing shortcomings is a sure way to lose respect. There are some times, of course, we should apologize, absolutely, and we'll get to that too. But we're talking now about apologizing too much. One time, one of my 7th or 8th grade students was having difficulty in math, and I was kind of at the end of my rope knowing how to actually help her. She stood by my desk while I sat at my desk, and we were discussing the problem, and I was just sort of out of options, and I was kind of twisting my ruler, and all of a sudden that thing went poof, and it smacked her in the face. Apologize? Of course. All right? Apologize for the obvious. Definitely apologize for the obvious. If there's a mistake in the book, as you will find them, you don't need to make big apologies for things that you aren't responsible for. Right? I think we'll move on. I'm not going to try to be 100% balanced in my approach here, okay? We're trusting you to be intelligent, process these things. If I give all the disclaimers and exceptions to the rule, this probably isn't going to work out. Right? Second one is wanting too much to be liked. Wanting too much to be liked by the students. Yes, you want to be friendly with students, but you can't be their best friend and teacher both. Right? You see, best friends aren't constantly giving their friends grades. That is where being teacher and being friend separate. If your friend comes wearing the most horrible mustard yellow dress that you ever did see and they ask you, "What do you think of my dress?" You're kind of stuck. Only about one thing you're going to say if you're their buddy, you know. "Oh, nice." Right? You can't do that as a teacher all the time. You can't. Giving grades and feedback are required for you as a teacher. And it is the point on which wanting to be liked too much and being a friend, it breaks down and trouble begins. You don't have to participate in every conversation, especially when it's about whether Fords are better than Chevys and those kind of things. You need to stay above the fray. because if you're involved in the fray, there'll be nobody to bring that fray to closure. Another one is getting discouraged. This relates to self-concept. Right now, as was said a few days ago, you're in the fantasy stage. If you've never taught before, you're imagining yourself being a teacher. But then when things don't work out as you hoped, well then, as the scripture says, hope deferred, hope held back, makes the heart what?
Sick.
That's right. If all your expectations are met this year, you probably weren't expecting enough. One of my friends, the second week that he was teaching school, a board member came in and asked him how it's going, and he said, it's terrible. And he actually got quite exercised, I won't demonstrate, but tears started running down his cheeks, and he said, all my air castles are falling to the ground. Well, that board member helped him see that maybe his expectations were a little too high. Maybe it related to point D, letting the little things affect your emotions. Little things can determine our ups and downs if we're not careful of it. There's a lot of daily grievances with teaching school. Well, find both the big picture and the detailed picture. We call this the micro view, the microscope, right? And the macro view. Have them both. One mountain climber, someone asked him how he does it. How does he keep his orientation in the forest? This being before the days of these hiking apps and GPS and so on. He said, well, he said, I keep in my mind where I last saw the peak. That's the macro view. And then he said, I watch where I put my feet. That's the micro view. So it takes a balance between two. If we become consumed with the bumps on the path and the rocks and the sticks, why, we forget about the big picture where we're actually trying to head. I remember in a Bible class one time I got all upset because my expectations weren't being met, and I wasn't able to motivate my students. They weren't putting themselves into it. But my day was a fiasco when really all it was is just not even all the students, but a few of the students were consistently not applying themselves in Bible. And again, it took someone else to pull me out because I was letting little things determine the ups and downs. If you find that something little happens and you have a reaction far greater than what actually happened, why then you're being consumed by little things. Not so long ago, I was putting a roof on my shop, nailing shingles, and I was feeling pressured by not only the shingle project, but by other things. I wanted to get this project completed, and my tape measure rolled off the roof. And I had to think about this thing of my response was out of proportion to the simple fact that my tape measure rolled off the roof. I mean, that's pretty easily remedied, right? But what was happening is I was letting little things determine my ups and downs. At this point, it was down, right? And I was, I wasn't thinking enough about the big picture. Just go pick up the tape measure and move on. So if the photocopier doesn't work and it ruins your day, there's some indication of something there that we better be thinking about. All right? E is feeling too responsible for the students. A teacher is a sympathetic guide. That's the way the teacher should view themselves, a sympathetic guide. Your job is not to carry students on your back, not even one of them, to the summit. All right? Your goal, rather, is to guide them on the hike to knowledge. The student must recreate in their own mind. We aren't giving free wheelbarrow rides. That's not our job. The only one working is the one learning. And if we're the only one working in the classroom, why then we're the only one learning. Right? Our students must be engaged. I remember the first year that I taught, there was a boy that I was really trying hard to make his experience at school a success. His parents were coming from, not from within our fellowship, but they were coming from the community and were interested in the church, and the stakes were kind of high, you know. And I was trying to give him a very good experience at school, and midterm they pulled him out. And I felt awful for that. I really did. And in some respects, I'd never quite gotten over it. But when I stop and think about the reason they took him out of school, the straw that broke the camel's back was they thought that they didn't agree with the stories that were in the readers. And the one that broke the camel's back was when he had to read from the martyr's mirror, something that was too gory. Was that my fault that he was taken out of school, if that's what the parents were saying was the main reason? No, not really, right? Well, let's not feel too responsible. Let's be the sympathetic guide. Let's get help in thinking through these things. All right, F is being too perfectionistic. Right? Being too much of a perfectionist will get us down as well. This relates to our self-concept in that we think that unless we do a perfect job, well, we just don't quite measure up. Well, that's not in fact the case. What you're fixing to experience is not like a picture in the Bible storybook or a model story for Wee Lamb's papers. It's not going to be that way. Life is inherently messy, right? And one of my favorite pictures as a child in the Bible storybook is where they were letting down that man, that lame man, to Jesus through the roof, and the friends tore off the roof. Well, Jesus is standing there, and everything is clean, and it's not dusty, and Jesus is smiling just the way Jesus should smile, and everything else. I'm sure Jesus smiled the way Jesus should smile, don't get me wrong. It's really an unrealistic picture. There was dirt and dust and mess. Did you ever tear off a roof? Much less a roof made out of the way Bible times were, probably thatch. Jesus probably had straw in his hair. Right? Do you like to teach with straw in your hair? I don't. Right? And so on. And you know, the pressure was all around, and it was kind of like all of a sudden this thing starts coming down, get back, or more press. Right? Well, if we're too perfectionistic, these things aren't going to work out so well for us. There's a phrase that we need to understand. This applies to a lot of things, and that is this. Sustainable best. Right? I cringe a little bit when I hear myself or hear others say, "Are you doing your best?" Well, listen, if I had to, I could probably climb up this wall barehanded, maybe even run across halfway across the ceiling if it was a big enough monster. You know what I mean? Okay. That's nowhere near my sustainable best. Right? Teachers need to find their sustainable best. There's some times that we can really give it the effort. Right? But it's not sustainable. We have to find sustainable best and then work that. Right, G is resisting advice. You know, when you resist advice, you're saying something about yourself. You're saying that I don't need you because I myself am okay. And you really ought to be listening to me. There was a situation in which I was asked to help where the board was a bit frustrated with the teacher. He was not very effective in his teaching. And they asked specifically that I would sit in one of his classes and try to analyze that class and take as much time as I needed, and so I made a few observations and then I visited with him. And the first thing he said, "Well, you got to understand that every year that I went to school, I had a different teacher." And so he said, "I really had tremendous exposure to a lot of different people, and I've harvested the best from every one." I guess we'll cease reading there, as a pastor says, right? Nothing else to say, right? Think of another situation. A friend of mine, she went out of state to teach, a little bit like some of you are, and it didn't take too long until things started trickling back that not all was well. And it had to do with this thing of resisting advice. She had some ideas about the way school should be run, and she jolly well was going to do that because she, after all, was a teacher and was given responsibility and authority, and you know the line. It got so bad that her former teacher was asked to give her a call and plead with her. Can you please listen to those who you're working for? And that's what he said. He said, "There's some that have traveled this road far longer than you have, and you better listen to them." And she went on this self-defense thing, wasn't listening to him either. And he said, almost said her name. He said, "I have no hope to offer you." And that's the way the phone call ended. She came home before Thanksgiving. It's a pitfall. Right? It has to do with self-concept. Listen to advice. Yes, you're given responsibility, but those who gave you responsibility actually have more responsibility than you for the school, and you better listen to them. All right, let's go to the second main point, ignorance of technique. And I see now that I totally forgot to bring my prop. Are you finished with that straw?
Yes,
sir. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. So suppose it's the first time I see a straw and I'm told that it's used in a cup. And so I put it in the cup. Well, whoever came up with such a dumb thing? Ignorance of technique, right? You don't eat a straw like that. I mean, well, whatever. You heard about the man who was given a banana for the first time, and someone asked him later, how did you enjoy it? Well, he said, it's not too bad if you go for that sort of thing. He said, a little stringy, a little tough, and seemed to have an awful lot of core. But you got what's happening. Not sure how he ate it, like corn on the cob, I suppose. The first one I have here is expecting books and gadgets to do the teaching. Books are helpful, and some gadgets are too, but they can't replace a teacher that knows what to do and how to do it. Right? Beware at this point of overdosing on electronics. More students have been taught without computers and with it. Right? You don't have to feel like because our school doesn't allow as much computer use as what you would like, you're hampered. You might not be hampered. You might actually be liberated. Right? Another place that this isn't actually doing the teaching, but another place while we're talking about technology that we spend a lot of time is grade management. I think that especially beginning teachers are fascinated with the data, and especially schools where there's daily grades taken. They have all sorts of fancy programs to manage the data and make pie graphs and everything else. And I remember one of our teachers of my children, when we had a parent-teacher interview, why they slid across some papers, and it was all about data, pages of data, parsing the data this way and that way and the other way, and it was okay, but it seemed like that was all that individual really wanted to talk about. Well, Warren Buffett says, you remember who he is, right? One of the richest men in America. He says that games are won by players who focus on the playing field, not by whose eyes are fixed on the scoreboard. Right. He's right. Grades are only a small slice of what happened at school. Right. So when things don't go right, thinking now, broadening out again to books and gadgets, when things don't go right, who gets the blame? The book? The computer? No, the teacher gets the blame. And it's right that they do. That's entirely appropriate. Teachers have used worse books than yours, and they've used them successfully. All right. If you back up 40 years, 50 years, and there were some of the early attempts in the story of Christian education, teachers had it tough, and they had success. Right. And while CLE reps might come around to your school and they might want to know about how things can get better, I guess I cringe a little bit, especially some of these young bucks or does, whatever. That they have an earful, and they just think that if only, instead of having one of the things we hear sometimes is, why do you print it in 10 little booklets? Why can't you put it all together and make it sound like the world would even be better greased and spin better on its axis if they wouldn't have it in 10 little booklets? Well, maybe that's all right. Maybe it should be in one booklet. I don't know, but you know what? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. B, not knowing the sequence of class preparation. The sequence of class, presentation. I said preparation, I meant to say presentation. There are some things that should happen in the presentation of knowledge, right? One of the things is that you got to link the unknown to something they already know, right? You have to teach the unknown in terms of the known. That's one of the sequences of class preparation. Another thing that enters in here is, how are you going to get the students to read the lesson? I think many teachers do less than the best on this, and they teach a lesson in math or language, or even history and science, and they teach it
try to do a good job of it. And then the assignment is to do thus and so numbers. And the student doesn't even read the lesson. Right? Well, the proper sequence of class presentation might just be requiring the student to read the lesson before you have any class on it. Right? I found that to be helpful. I wouldn't have a class in math and English for sure if they hadn't read the lesson. And they had to be able to say, yes, I read the lesson before I'd have a class on it, because otherwise they wouldn't read the lesson. Who was it printed for anyway? Right. Teaching is reproducing in the student's mind the lesson to be taught. Okay? And so you have to engage the student's mind. Our well-defined curriculum does take care of a lot of this for us. But not knowing the sequence of class preparation is a pitfall. C, giving too much or too little work. You give too much work, well, we don't want that now, do we? You give too little work, well, we don't want that either. I said at this institute a number of years ago, I never quite forgot it. It was a Jonathan Miller Bing. He said that summer he had baled hay. And the question is always, you know, am I going fast enough or am I going too slow? Could the baler handle more? Or am I pushing it in too fast and going to make clogs and so forth? But he said his instructor told him, he said, you listen for this certain, he described it as a squeak. He said it wasn't really a squeak, but it was a certain noise that the machine made, and you knew you were working at optimum efficiency, maximum capacity. And when the machine got to that point where it was going, or something like that, I don't know. You need to know that maximum efficiency, not too much, but enough. And this is something that you develop by knowing your students and by knowing your classroom. You want to have that squeak, if you will, that indicates everything's fine. Here we are. Giving poor questions. We'll not talk about this a whole lot because it is true that our well-developed curriculum answers this. Sometimes we ask questions and we want a response from our students and they don't know what you're driving at all. Or maybe you've asked a pitfall on the other side of the road. You've asked a question that's almost insults their intelligence. It's too simple, and they don't want to answer that either. Right? So think through. This thing of asking provocative questions is a whole field of study and skill in itself. Beware of test questions, especially that the student can't know because you didn't address it in your class and there was no questions to support it. One curriculum I taught, it was a particular, I think it was a biology course, a particular edition of biology in Abeka. It did this so often that finally I had to lay aside the pre-made tests and write my own. All right, let's go to E, not getting enough feedback from the class. Do the students know what their assignments are? How do you know that they know what their assignments are? Can they understand your accent? I had to be told that by the board, that I have a strange accent. Do you think I have a strange accent? I don't, but maybe I do. Right? How do you know that the students are getting it? Can they repeat the instructions you gave them verbally back to you? Would be one way. Now, sometimes we tend to use words that just go over their head. I remember one time where I had come to this school, I started giving grades in art. Well, that hadn't been part of the school culture there. They had not given grades in arts. Art was a time to kick back, relax, and enjoy the trip. And they didn't like it that they were getting graded in that whole kick back, relax process. And a fifth grader asked me, why are we getting grades? And I said, well, because of incentive. And he was quiet, and I thought all was well, right? Because, you know, I looked for feedback, perhaps, and felt that quietness was, you know, meant he was put to rest. A little while later, I heard him asking his older brother, what does incentive mean? Well, I hadn't communicated anything, did I? We're talking about getting feedback. One time I was having a discussion in the Russian school. I didn't make them look up in the dictionary everything that maybe I should have, but after all, they probably had more language than I did if you counted their Russian, Ukrainian, and so on. But one of the girls was asking what frisking means. And I said, well, frisk is like a pat-down. Like you're at an airport, security, and if you get frisked, that means that they're suspecting that maybe you have weapons or you're hiding something. And she said, well, is it okay to say frisking down? Well, I said, maybe so. Okay, so a little while later, she was asking, what does this sentence mean? And she read, two lambs were frisking down in the meadow. Hadn't quite connected. Got feedback from your class. All right, let's go to letter F, pressuring students without directing them. Pressuring students without directing them. You know, if a student doesn't know what to do and you're putting on pressure for him to just do it, you're going to cause frustration really quickly in your students. I know it can be frustrating when students aren't getting it, but this might not be his fault, all right? Maybe you might feel it after you went to all the work of explaining. He should know, and maybe he should, but there might be a missing link in their understanding. You might have that link, and they don't. You might not know that they don't have it. Don't pressure a student without giving them proper direction. Assigning without motivating. We can't talk about this much. Motivation is a whole subject of its own for study. But if you're given a writing assignment that says your assignment is to write a 600-word essay on whatever subject you like, and then you sit down, well, you've assigned without motivating, and students aren't going to respond well to that. H, failing to keep track of slow students. That's right. Students fall behind quietly. They don't ring their alarm bells, toot whistles of alarm. Not all of them. Some of them will, but not all of them. And we're so busy. It can get so busy working the system and keeping the average and the above average engaged that we let them fall behind. Watch those slower students. Help them. They need you. Thinking for the student. From the seven laws of teaching, which there's a class on that later today. One of the laws is teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or master the desired art. We do all the thinking for the students aren't going to learn. Right? Learning, then, here's another law. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth. Thinking into your own understanding. The student, of course, working into a habit, a new skill or art. And that happens by the students being engaged. Too often teachers go home tired and weary because they were doing the work, too much of the work. And the students aren't learning enough because the teacher's doing too much of the work. In Spokane, in a city park, not so far from where I taught, there was a big sign with a rather detailed explanation. The basic message was, do not feed the ducks. And the main point of the explanation said that too many visitors at the park were giving free handouts to the ducks. And last winter, when the cold weather came and the pond froze over, there were ducks stuck in the ice because they were too fat to fly. And gave a number there of how many thousands of dollars were paid to transport those ducks south by car. Fat ducks, every one of them. The same thing can happen in your classroom. Right? And you can make fat ducks. Do not feed the ducks. Do not feed the bears. There's reasons that those sign that we get those instructions from time to time. All right, third point, poor planning. Poor planning. This is another pitfall that many teachers fall into. We are planning poorly when, A, we neglect the important things to do urgent things. You need to decide what you're going to prioritize. We need now to choose, when we're a teacher, which is urgent and which is important. Yes, these things change, like filling your car with gas. It can become urgent, right? But plan your life, plan your work. We must choose to sleep enough. We must choose to read enough, exercise enough, worship enough. Those kind of things. We make these decisions. But if we're neglecting the important, sorry, if we're neglecting the urgent to do the important, why, we're going to find ourselves in a pothole. Another is worrying about failing to allow for the unexpected. Failing to allow for the unexpected. We pack things so tightly, or if we maybe don't do the science experiment first when we should have, why we're going to get some unexpected surprises. I'm just going to read here a bit about failing to allow for the unexpected. If you think your schedule is established to stay, and if you think you know the exact standards you will use to give your students their A, B's, and C's, you might be in for a surprise. Think of teaching as a little like farming. I like that. Sometimes a farmer has to make allowances for rain, frost, salesmen, and cantankerous cows. Farmers and teachers do not always get what they want when they want it. So true. Right on to C is worrying about not having enough to say. Well, if you study properly and you absorb the material and absorb it in life, you have plenty to say. D, not planning in enough detail. You know, you should go through the procedure first. Do some of the student exercises. Just thinking about the thing is okay in part, but too often we can uncover problems by doing the things which we're expecting the students would do. We can uncover problems which would not have occurred if only we thought of, if the only thing we did was thinking about it. Sometimes we need to go through the function that we're going to do. E is spending too much time on peripheral activities. Peripheral, P-E-R-I-P-H-E-R-A-L. Peripheral means off to the side. Class time, study time, your personal preparation before 8 and 3, all of that depends on focusing on the right thing. You know, we can tinker too much with our computer. We can tinker too much maybe with our fellow teachers, and visiting can get too long and too extended. All these things are good, legitimate. Keep the main thing the main thing. All right, ineffective discipline is our fourth main area. Being afraid to discipline for fear that the students won't like you. Postponing discipline for later usually doesn't work out that well. Typically, it makes it harder, and it also may foster disrespect. But as Brian Tracy says, when you must eat a frog, eat it. Just do it. Get it done. And if you have two frogs to eat, he goes on to say, eat the uglier one first. That way it's only better when you have to eat the second one, right? Well, some things that are unhandy to do, very unpleasant. We just have to steel ourselves and do them. Otherwise, we're going to be in a pothole or in a pitfall. Right? Over-lecturing, B, instead of disciplining. You know, it's easy to talk and talk and talk. And again, postpone the discipline until later. Talk first, of course. But finally, there comes a time when we have to just do. We have to act on what the student's behavior tells us to act on. Again, I'm going to read from page 536, 537 here. To cure yourself, remember how it was as a student when you admired the strong, silent teacher who moved ahead with discipline. Remember, too, how disappointed you were with the teacher of whom students said he talks and talks, but he doesn't do anything. Right? I had a fifth and sixth grade teacher. She was very effective. She had, I think it was 36 or 38 students. And one of the reasons that she was effective is when she said something, you were held accountable. It was just that simple. And one time she said that nobody may throw snowballs at recess. She had said this when we were all eating lunch at various spots in the room. I was the one the furthest possible from her. Just happened that way. It wasn't that I was fearing her. And I didn't actually hear what she said, but I thought it didn't matter. Well, I went out and started throwing snowballs, and after a while, a few others started throwing snowballs too. And after recess, she said, how is it that you did exactly what I told you not to do? And a whole bunch of people pointed at me. Right? I was innocent. I truly was. And she said she'll meet me outside after the service or whatever. And so she did. And I said, I never heard you say anything like it. I said, when did you say it? I have no idea. She said, I said it just before we dismissed at the end of lunch. And I said, well, I didn't hear everything you were saying. She said she'll think about it. Well, the next day we didn't have school because of snow. It was a snow day. And the next day was Saturday. And the next day was Sunday. And it was, mind you, a long weekend because of what I just told you. We knew that she was not going to let the matter rest. Right? I knew that something was coming. I guess we'll cease reading there, too. No, she did ask me. She said, you're serious. You didn't hear. I said, no, I didn't hear. She said, we'll let it go this time, once. She said, you better listen. And I did. Over-lecturing instead of disciplining. All right, C is trusting the students too much. Little angels though they appear, they might be doing things undercover. The Bible says we're to watch and pray, and one teacher literally did that. He saw one of the students standing on their head, deer in prayer. Right? How a student can get from feet to head without him knowing, he actually had to watch while he was praying to see that it happened. Do your students shut their eyes when you have prayer? How do you know? Right, you're going to have to watch and pray. You're going to have to do some other things sometimes, some watching at other times. Have to be a little unexpected sometimes in where you might appear next. There's when there's cleaning going on, or maybe even recess or free periods. Be a little unexpected. Just show up. One time I had a student teacher, and I had a dentist appointment, I think it was, and I came back to school. I was pretty sure she was doing a good job. I wasn't sure about, I didn't trust all the students because of some stuff that was happening, but it so happened that day there were some workmen there, and there was an extension ladder not so far from my class window. So I just got it and moved it over. My classroom was a little bit of a situation like this on the second floor, but not a window, not a roof beside it. I just climbed in and looked in my own classroom window, and it was really interesting what all I saw. And it so happened that I was about this far from one of the boys' heads. And he was doing the right thing. He was engaged. He was studying. And all of a sudden, whoosh, you know, he didn't even know what he jumped for, but there I was, you know, right beside him. There can be a problem of trusting your students too little, too. That can be a problem as well. But trusting your students too much. So what are you going to do if you need to go out to the office? And last time you went out to the office and came back in, there was stuff happening that shouldn't have. Well, there's ways to handle that. One of the things I like to ask my students before I'd go out in a situation like that is say something a little like this. Last time I went out, and when I came back in, why, some stuff was happening that shouldn't have. Is that right? Yeah. Their heads are nodding a little bit. Well, can I trust you to do the right things while I'm gone? You see your hand this time. Well, some people put their hand up, no problem. You know, the ones that aren't troublemakers, the ones you know you can trust. But the ones whose hands don't go up, well, they just say, fine, come along. They'll soon develop trustworthiness, right? And then when we go out to the office, we get a few things other than just papers, or they get a few things other than just papers. They get some advice about how to behave and so on. What time does the period end?
11.
Well, there's the answer. Let's go to some novice teacher advantages. There are some advantages of being a first-year teacher, and that is typically there is a willingness to learn and be led. Right? Some of us who've been around for a while, we think we know how to do it. My dad had a tomato greenhouse, a hydroponic tomato greenhouse, and he was given a manual. He went to a three-day school to know how to do this thing, and he was given a manual. And that first year, he pored over that manual. I can still see him doing it. And the second year, he looked at it too. But the third year, he was pretty sure there were some things wrong with that manual. And so I remember him telling Mother, he said, I'm going to put that manual away. Our crop production went down by about 3,000 pounds that year. Right? Beginners often are more willing to learn and be led. Another thing is freshness. Freshness. Some of us that have been around for a while, why, we suffer from hardening of the our attitudes. That's what I meant to say, yes. And we become terminally academic, and our freshness suffers. Another one is friendliness. Perhaps it's not as long of a journey back to when you were a student. And first year beginner teachers generally excel in friendliness, and that's good. And another one that's closely related to these ideas, and that is sympathy. Sympathy. You can sympathize with people perhaps better than someone who's been teaching for 45 years or 47, whatever we heard it was. Well, be aware of the potholes, be aware of the pitfalls, and that awareness is the first step to avoiding them. Stop, look, listen. I remember my dad saying that he was riding with somebody and they came to a stretch of dirt road that it was so full of potholes that they were weaving all over the road this way and that way trying to avoid all these potholes. And they still hit a lot. A little while later, he was riding with someone else and they came to the same stretch of road and the man didn't flinch. He just held the wheel straight. And Dad said, well, that was an interesting way to deal with that stretch of road. Well, he said, you can't hit them all. Maybe that's the best advice that we can give. Look where you want to go. Look towards success. Give it a firm hand. Listen to your passengers. Listen to your dispatchers. Trust God, and you'll be fine. Thank you.